Donald Trump will look at what happened in Venezuela and say, well, I did it so smoothly and bloodlessly. By the way, they killed Venezuelans, including Venezuelan civilians. But no Americans were lost. And I got praised by people in the media for my wonderful win. That's the kind of hubris that would allow someone like Trump to go, well, maybe we should do it in Iran. Maybe I should listen to Lindsey Graham and Benjamin Netanyahu and Marco Rubio and do it in Iran. Of course, Iran is a very different kettle of fish to Venezuela. Mm. That won't be a walk in the park, I can assure you.
Manny, when you talk about Nigeria, let's not forget it's the largest oil producer in Africa.
Coincidental, Amy. Completely coincidental.
And Iran, of course, overthrown in 1953 by the United States, the democratically elected leader, on behalf of BP. So oil all the way, not to mention Iraq in 2003 when you mentioned George W. Bush. I just wanted to go to Jeffrey Sachs, speaking at the UN Security Council yesterday, the director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University.
In the past month, President Trump has issued direct threats against six UN member states, including Colombia, Denmark, Iran, Mexico, Nigeria, and of course, Venezuela. Members of the Council are not called upon to judge Nicolas Maduro. They are not called upon to assess whether the recent U.S. attack and ongoing naval quarantine results in freedom or in subjugation. Members of the Council are called upon to defend international law and specifically the UN Charter.
So that was Professor Jeffrey Sachs. Mehdi Hasan, in this last 30 seconds, supposedly on Thursday, there's going to be a vote and a debate in the U.S. Senate on the War Powers Act. Can you talk about the significance of this and where you see this all headed? President Maduro is expected to be back in court. I think it's March 17th.
Well, we don't know if he's going to actually win or lose. The Trump DOJ doesn't have a great record in prosecuting people. It will be hilarious if they lost and Maduro walked free. Let's see. Very quickly, the story of the Trump administration at home has been people rolling over for him. Big law, big universities, big tech, all of the banks, all rolling over him. Universities rolling over for Trump. And now the story on the international stage is the same. European allies cannot bring themselves to condemn what Trump did. The British government embarrassingly could not even say he shouldn't take Greenland. America's wrong to be threatening Greenland. Congress has abdicated its role on foreign policy, on war making. So at every stage, Donald Trump, luckiest man in the world, finds no opposition. I think this is all going to come bite everyone in their backsides very quickly. If he does take Greenland, the Europeans will feel very foolish for not standing together when he went and went after Venezuela.
Mehdi Hasan, award-winning journalist, editor-in-chief, and CEO of Zatteo. We'll link to your piece, Trump's Venezuela Attack. It's all about the oil, stupid. Coming up, Alexander Avinya, associate professor of Latin American history at Arizona State University, on the Trump's calling the Dunro Doctrine. Stay with us.
Ours is just another skin, simply slips away. You can rise above it. It will shed easily. It all will come out fine. I've learned it line by line. One coming wire, one silver thread, all that you desire rolls on.
Grateful, performed by Patti Smith in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we look now at how Trump's military attack on Venezuela will impact Latin America, where the U.S.-led coup on Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has resurfaced the historical echoes of decades of U.S. intervention in the region. The U.S. State Department posting a message online saying, quote, this is our hemisphere, and President Trump will not allow our security to be threatened, unquote. The comment followed remarks by President Trump, who referenced the Monroe Doctrine, a credo enacted by U.S. President James Monroe in 1823 that's been repeatedly invoked by U.S. presidents in order to justify U.S. political and military interventions in Latin America and the Caribbean through much of the 20th and 21st centuries. This is President Trump speaking Saturday.
And the Monroe Doctrine is a big deal, but we've superseded it by a lot. by a real lot. They now call it the Monroe Doctrine. I don't know. It's Monroe Doctrine. We sort of forgot about it. It was very important, but we forgot about it. We don't forget about it anymore. Under our new national security strategy, American dominance in the Western Hemisphere will never be questioned again.
Leftist governments across Latin America swiftly condemned the U.S. military attack on Venezuela and Maduro's abduction. Colombian President Gustavo Petro said Monday he would, quote, take up arms for his country if necessary, in response to Trump's threats against Colombia. Petro also said in a statement, quote, come get me, I'm waiting for you here, unquote, as Trump specifically targeted Petro, claiming without evidence Petro's involvement in cocaine trafficking. Trump has also threatened military action against Cuba and Mexico. This is Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum.
Mexico's position against any form of intervention is firm, clear, and historic. Following recent events in Venezuela, where the United States government carried out a direct intervention that resulted in the capture of President Nicolas Maduro and his wife, as well as the loss of human lives, Mexico reaffirms a principle that is not new and admits no ambiguities. We categorically reject intervention in the internal affairs of other countries. Latin America's history is clear and compelling. Intervention has never brought democracy, never generated well-being or lasting stability. Only the people themselves can build their own future, decide their path, exercise sovereignty over their natural resources, and freely define their form of government. Our position is clearly enshrined in the Constitution of the United Mexican States.
That was the Mexican president, Claudia Sheinbaum. For more, we go to Phoenix, Arizona, where we're joined by Alexander Avina, associate professor of Latin American history at Arizona State University, who's extensively researched and written about capitalism, the U.S.-backed war on drugs and state violence, author of the award-winning book Spectres of Revolution, Peasant Guerrillas in the Cold War Mexican Countryside. So if you can talk, Professor Avina, about what this attack on Venezuela means for Latin America, what some are calling the re-hemisphering of Latin America.
Good morning, Amy. I think this is, you know, contrary to what Trump was saying, the Monroe Doctrine has never quite been forgotten by the United States. It's just the methods of enforcing it or implementing it in the region have varied across presidential administrations and across political parties. I think it bears to keep in mind that U.S. empire in Latin America is a bipartisan project that involved both Republican and Democratic parties. Just thinking about how President Obama is the one who labeled Venezuela a threat to U.S. national security back in 2015 is one pertinent example. So I think what we're witnessing now is just a quite visible and unabashed assertion of U.S. power over Latin America. Now, that's one way to read it. The other way to read this move, and particularly in light of the national security strategy, it's a moment to read it as a moment of U.S. weakness, right? They're basically conceding other parts of the world to peer rivals. They've more or less accepted that they cannot compete frontally with China, for example, in Asia. So as has happened in the past, when the U.S. has forced resistance or defeat elsewhere in the world, they come back, quote unquote, home to the Western Hemisphere, and they use Latin America as an imperial laboratory, as they have since almost the founding of the United States. So the U.S. has long served, as historians like Greg Grandin have written about, as a workshop of empire where the U.S. gets to refine its imperialist tactics abroad. But they also use those moments to try to create internal domestic political hegemony, depending on which political party or which political coalition is in the ascendancy. The difference now, I think, is that this is, again, to reiterate, this is a moment of U.S. weakness internationally, but I think also for the Trump coalition is a moment of weakness internally. So, the way I read this is you know, if you have to continually have to say that you're strong and you're powerful and that you own the Americas constantly online through different images, through different public appearances, in a way that's a weakness, right? The fact that you have to continuously assert how powerful you are. So that's one way to read it.
Talk about the Monroe Doctrine, what most people, you know, certainly don't understand, going back to the early 1800s.
So the Monroe Doctrine is famously contains multiple meanings. I mean, it depends on who's reading it, at what moment in time, et cetera. But initially, this was not a law, right? It was a promulgation of President James Monroe that asserted that Latin America or the Americas was to remain a place strictly for Americans, broadly defined, of the region. And it was a sort of an anti-colonial statement against European rival powers in the context of Latin American independence wars. And initially, Latin American independence leaders like Simón Bolívar saw this as a positive. They figured that the United States was going to be an ally in their efforts to overthrow colonial rule. But even someone like Bolívar really quickly learned that the United States was not going to play that role and that it was going to just resume the imperialist control over the region that had previously been taken up by European powers. The other important moment in this history is when with President Theodore Roosevelt invoked his own Roosevelt corollary in the early 20th century, when he essentially made the United States an international police power over the Americas, and it justified constant U.S. military intervention in the region using the justification of that any quote unquote loosening of ties of civilization in Latin America would then trigger some sort of U.S. police response in the form of U.S. Marines invading Latin American countries to the tune of about 34 between 1900 to 1934. And then Trump comes in and he talked about a Trump corollary, and now he's taken over the entire Monroe Doctrine to call it the Monroe Doctrine. And again, as your previous guest was saying, it's difficult to assign some sort of serious ideological coherence to whatever Trump says. But I do see that this is an effort to coalesce a really fractious internal political coalition within his party, within the United States, at the same time that it's wielding illegal, violent actions against sovereign Latin American nations like Venezuela.
And when you look at the history of the U.S. involved with the coup against Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954, as he was trying to enact land reform, against Allende, who died in the palace on another September 11th, 1973, as the U.S.-backed Pinochet forces rose to power. Do you see this as an extension of this as we wrap up?
Yeah, I do. And again, it's just part of this long history of constant U.S. intervention in the region to prevent and not tolerate Latin American assertions of sovereignty and self-determination. Those two examples are also good to highlight that it doesn't matter what type of Latin American leader is in power and how they achieve that power. In the end, if they are deemed intolerable or antithetical to U.S. imperial designs, they are going to be overthrown or destabilized by the United States. You could have St. Francis as the president, and he will still be overthrown by the United States if a president of this country deems that leader to be a threat or an obstacle to U.S. imperial designs and what they have long characterized as, quote unquote, our hemisphere, our backyard. So this is just one more action. The one relatively new thing, is that they're using narco-terrorism charges against President Nicolás Maduro. And that's a more recent 1980s origin story, but it still fits within this longer history of constant U.S. violation of Latin American sovereignty and attempts to assert self-determination.
Alexander Avina, I want to thank you for being with us. Associate Professor of Latin American History at Arizona State University. He's researched and written about capitalism, the U.S.-backed war on drugs, and state violence. Coming up, we speak to a Wall Street Journal reporter on oil stocks surging, especially Chevron, and also how the Trump family businesses have generated at least $4 billion since Trump was reelected. In December, Trump Media merged with a company aiming to build the world's first viable nuclear fusion plant to power AI projects. Stay with us.
The taste of money, the smell of wealth, oh, so tempting, but it's bad for your health. They're quick to tell you there's not enough. We've got what we want. Keep your hands off our stuff. You hear the warning, you get the point. You dare to put their nose out of joint. They keep on saying there's not enough. We've got what we want. Keep your hands off our stuff. once upon a time, we would talk to share. You heard it all the time, but they're all birds of a feather together in crime. It's not what you're about.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to look at how the U.S. attack on Venezuela has impacted Wall Street. On Monday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 600 points to a new all-time high. Shares in the oil giant Chevron jumped 5%. We're joined now by Wall Street Journal reporter David Uberti. Thanks so much for being with us. Thanks. Why don't we start off there? Talk about the significance of Chevron in Venezuela, and President Trump saying he didn't consult Congress, but he did talk to corporate executives before and after the U.S. attack on Venezuela and the abduction of the president.
Right. Well, U.S. oil companies have had a long history in Venezuela over the course of decades. ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, Chevron. A number of them left Venezuela in the mid-2000s after the government nationalized many assets in that sector. But Chevron has been the sole player to continue navigating the sort of political and economic environment in Venezuela since then. More recently, operating on a license agreement with the U.S. government to basically get around U.S. sanctions. Now, investors on Wall Street believe because of that imprint within Venezuela right now, Chevron is potentially best positioned to capitalize on any new opportunities to come within Venezuela. That said, it's an extremely long road to any of that happening. In addition to the geology that's at question with Venezuela, they have very large oil reserves. There's also the question of decrepit infrastructure in the country, which will take billions of dollars of investment in years of time, as well as the other above-ground factors at play, which mean political and legal institutions in the country that have withered over the course of time and that the Trump administration has really called into question going forward, too.
And can you talk about Paul Singer, the billionaire supporter of President Trump, who bought Citgo, I think, at $5.9 billion. Now it's worth $18 billion.
Well, there's been investors across the map who have invested in various Venezuelan assets over the course of time, essentially playing the long game in the hope that something like this might happen and provide an opening for them to cash out those assets. Singer's invested in Citgo, which is the PDVSA, the state-run oil company in Venezuela. They own a downstream refining business and marketing business as well. It's been in forced sale proceedings for some time, and that might move forward in the months and years ahead.
You know, the world doesn't have much of an appetite for more oil. And some oil companies like Chevron are not sure about investing more in Venezuela. But in order to profit from this, since President Trump says the U.S. is controlling the oil supply in Venezuela, they have to push for more appetite for oil around the world.
The most important piece of information in the oil market is the price of oil. And yesterday, U.S. oil prices were something like $58 per barrel. Now, U.S. oil companies can make a profit at that prices. That said, Venezuelan oil trades at a discount for a bunch of nuanced reasons. But $58 a barrel is not sending a signal to companies in the U.S. and elsewhere, hey, why don't you spend billions of dollars to tap into unproven, decrepit reserves and infrastructure in a country that's unstable? So you saw there was an NBC interview last night that President Trump gave where he essentially suggested that U.S. might actually subsidize some of these oil companies going back into Venezuela. The word he used, I believe, was reimbursement. That seems like a very difficult political move to make. But that said, I think oil companies might need some sort of incentive in addition to the political and legal stability that they're looking out for to make those big decisions.
Former Chevron executive Ali Mashiri is raising $2 billion for Venezuelan oil projects, telling the Financial Times, quote, I've had a dozen calls over the past 24 hours from potential investors. Interest in Venezuela has gone from 0 to 99%. Has your reporting shown this?
There will always be speculators who are ready to pull the trigger on big bets in very unproven environments. I'd be curious to check in with that investor in a year or 2 years' time to see if he's actually raised that money and see if they're ready to actually pull the trigger on an investment decision, given whatever the political situation is in Venezuela.
And I'd be curious curious to know how the Trump family plans to profit, but which that takes us to your overall look at the Trump family. You're reporting on the Trump's family finances. In the Wall Street Journal, you recently revealed that ventures launched since Trump's reelection have generated at least $4 billion in proceeds and paper wealth for the Trump family. That figure based on company statements and security filings. In addition, you've reported how one of the family businesses, Trump Media and Technology, recently announced a $6 billion merger with a firm aiming to build the world's first viable nuclear fusion plant to power AI projects and data centers. This merger, particularly interesting given it was announced shortly after Trump signed an executive order to bar states and local governments from enacting their own AI regulations. If you can start off, David, on this issue of the massive Trump wealth that has been accumulated just in this first year of President Trump.
Right. The $4 billion figure that you mentioned, that's in proceeds and also paper wealth that have been generated strictly by businesses that have been launched since he's been elected. It's potentially a conservative estimate. This is only what has been made public, either through securities filings or federal disclosures made by the president or the first family. These range from the traditional real estate, golf, hotels business, but increasingly veer into things like cryptocurrency, different types of merchandise. You mentioned the fusion deal as well. And what we see is that, you know, Trump was in some cases elected because he's a businessman. He can run the government like a business. The potential byproduct of that is if you have a president who doesn't divest from his assets, as previous presidents have done, you have all of these different business interests in different areas in which the government regulates, which raises a lot of questions.
So talk about where the Trump investments are around the world.
They're totally global. The hotels, the real estate, the golf courses, they span everywhere from the United States to Ireland to South Asia, the Middle East as well. Cryptocurrency is by nature a global, you know, type of industry, and that's where you see the real money making being happening right now. We made this conservative investment not taking into account some of the meme coins the president and his family have generated. It's very difficult to track how much money or proceeds those types of things generate. But it's truly a global operation at this point. And it's worth saying that the White House and the Trump Organization, when we've corresponded with them, they say there is no conflict of interest. They've installed guardrails around all of this. But as our reporting shows, a lot of these assets lead back up into the Trump Revocable Trust, which is a trust in the vehicle that is ultimately controlled by Donald Trump Jr., and it benefits Donald Trump.
The biggest crypto venture is World Liberty Financial. Explain who owns it, what it is, and the countries it's working with.
World Liberty Financial was co-founded by Trump and his sons, as well as Steve Witkoff and his sons. It is owned basically 40% by entities linked to the Trump family, and through a complex ownership structure, various entities lead that investment back up into the Trump Revocable Trust. Now, World Liberty Financial issues its own governance tokens as well as stable coins, which are backed by U.S. Treasury bonds. And through both of those different offerings, they can get both trading fees as well as interest payments by their treasury holdings as well. As some of my colleagues reported, different investors in cryptocurrency around the world have either put money into these stablecoin offerings. Those span Middle East and Asian investors.
Be more specific when you talk about Middle East and South Asia. What are the countries that are pouring billions into these Trump family businesses?
More specifically, the founder of, as my colleagues have reported, the founder of Binance, who was recently under federal investigation, he made an investment. He bought some of the stable coins that World Liberty Financial offers, and that business deal was helped along in some instances by different Middle Eastern players as well. So this really spans different Gulf nations. These countries are very big into crypto. They're investing in this area in the hopes of diversifying their economies away from energy as well. And because the Trumps have become such a large player and they have many business and political collections, it's also almost natural in some senses that they would work together. And it just so happens that Donald Trump's the president as well.
Just so happens. So you've got the sons of Donald Trump. You've got the sons of the so-called peace envoy, Witkoff, where you have them all traveling together. And as the envoys leave, you've got the sons there. What do they gain by their parents, either the president of the United States or his number one representative in dealing with different countries, by being there in their wake? Have you been able to trace that?
It certainly hasn't hurt their prospects. We've spoken to people, bankers, investors, potential business partners in different industries. You know, they are attracted to the fact that the Trump family name carries a considerable amount of fame and power and has for some time. As I said, the White House says there is no conflict of interest. But it raises a lot of questions over sort of like the indirect ways in which the sort of proximity to power may help along some of these deals and the valuations at which they're made.
Let's get into the AI data centers and what fuel them. Talk about the Trump company that will now deal with nuclear fusion and the possibility of nuclear fusion powering. It requires massive energy, these data centers. And at the same time, President Trump issuing an executive order that would prevent states or local entities from regulating anything related to data centers.
Well, there's two things happening here. First and foremost, the Trump administration has been all in on AI data centers. They want to boost this as a new American industry, foment investment from the major players in Silicon Valley and elsewhere. They want to reduce as many regulations as possible, both to build data centers and to build the energy infrastructure, mostly natural gas infrastructure, as well as nuclear, but that is needed to power those data centers. So that's what's happening on one part of the industry side of things. At the same time, Trump Media, which is originally founded, as you know, as sort of a holding company for the Truth Social media platform, has really sort of traveled through the wilderness in terms of finding an actual business to become over the last several years or so. They were founded in 2021 when Donald Trump was very much in the outs with corporate America and Wall Street. And this business deal with TAE Technologies, which is quite an established player in the nascent nuclear fusion field, it kind of represents full circle happening for that Trump family business empire. This is an established firm. It's backed by Goldman Sachs and Chevron, coincidentally. The Charles Schwab family is involved. These are very mainstream financial people in the United States. So you really see the Trumps increasingly integrating their business empire within, you know, the quote-unquote real economy in the U.S. as well as mainstream finance.
But this is very serious. For people to understand, AI data centers require massive amounts of energy, sometimes equivalent to what you would power a whole small city. And if you're talking about nuclear fusion, some have said that this energy source is decades away from actually manifesting itself. But if he's also in charge of the regulation, or more importantly, the deregulation of it, who's going to be in control of this?
The company claims that it can reach operations by 2031, which would be light speed, as per what you said previously. This is commercially unproven technology. There is capital behind this company now to make this all happen. But that said, it's kind of a moonshot, which follows sort of a well-worn path. If you were sort of to step back and look at the Trump interests, broadly speaking, they play in very speculative, highly risky corners of financial markets. And this is definitely one of those areas.
And the idea that the executive order says you cannot regulate AI data centers. I mean, a lot of the activism around the country now is around communities deeply concerned about these energy centers. President Trump is saying this would now be against the law.
Right. Those community organizations in different places around the country, which I visited, they are anathema to this idea of building out data centers as quickly as possible. You add in the element of the administration being very antagonistic toward renewable energy, things like solar and wind power. Solar in particular is very proven and quite cheap in some circumstances, and instead being all in on fossil fuels, which are obviously more polluting in many circumstances, as well as this more unproven technology of nuclear, which the U.S. has a very checkered history with.
We have to leave it there, but we're going to do part two after the show. David Uberti of The Wall Street Journal. I'm Amy Goodman.
Broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain, BC, we are CJSF 90.1 FM, and we are diverse, independent, and yours.
My name's Eric Swanson, and I'm a dad of two young girls. It was a game changer when we learned that $10 a day childcare was being offered to both our kids. And we want all BC families to have this option. To get there, BC has to do three key things. Pay fair and consistent wages for all childcare educators. Transition all existing programs to $10 a day. And plan childcare expansion more like we do schools and hospitals. BC's on the right track, but we need to go faster. Go to 10aday.ca to learn more.